For listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the September 15th, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: despite poor jobs data and fear of tariff effects, Wall Street investors remain enthused about the prospects for an economic resurgence, especially if the Fed begins to lower interest rates. Appliance maker Whirlpool is stirring up a new trade dispute, telling the Trump administration that overseas competitors could be evading tariff bills by undervaluing their imports. The publisher of Rolling Stone sued Google, alleging that the AI summaries that appear atop search results are illegally using its reporting and depressing online traffic. The faltering labor market is pushing more Americans into part-time work and other roles they don't want, even under the surface of a low unemployment rate. Capital Group, a venerable mutual fund company known for its disciplined investments, has surprised observers with large bets on Bitcoin. Cattle ranchers are earning record profits as thin herds and high demand combine to drive up the price of beef. Brands including Coke and McDonald's are playing up their European credentials as the global view of the U.S. deteriorates under Trump. The Winklevoss twins crypto firm Gemini has earmarked up to 30% of shares at its IPO for individual investors, a strategy bankers say can stabilize a company's share price. Bank of America appointed two new co-presidents and elevated the title of the finance chief. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. Even as Trump portrays himself as a peacemaker, he is proving reluctant to exert U.S. leverage on Russia or Israel to end wars that those countries are fighting. Rubio said the U.S. wasn't happy about the Israeli strike on Hamas in Qatar, but moved ahead with a visit to Israel that includes meetings with Netanyahu. The 22-year-old suspect in the killing of Charlie Kirk isn't cooperating with authorities, although his family is, the governor of Utah said. As Democrats demand restoration of health care subsidies to avoid a government shutdown, party leaders appear more united than in the last spending showdown in March. A new prime minister took office in Nepal, urging calm and cooperation after days of violent protests last week left at least 72 people dead. Documents filed by Fed Governor Lisa Cook, whom Trump seeks to fire, could counter the administration's claim she misrepresented a property to get a mortgage. More women are using cannabis during pregnancy to deal with pain and nausea, often driven by a fear of how prescription drugs could affect their baby's health. The stock market appears to be a rising source of federal revenue, with signs of an increase in tax payments by those making capital gains. Personnel from a U.S. warship boarded a Venezuelan fishing boat in home waters, Caracas said, underlining strained relations with the U.S. The picture on today's front page shows three men wearing yarmulkes at what appears to be the Wailing Wall. And the caption, Moment of Prayer. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee visited the Western Wall on Sunday. Rubio began a visit to Israel after its strike on Hamas in Qatar. Administration officials insist Trump has a firm grip on foreign policy. The article, Qatar Strike Clouds Rubio's Israel Visit. Trip comes as U.S. hopes to break the logjam in talks to end the war in Gaza. By Robbie Gramer, Jerusalem. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the U.S. wasn't happy about the Israeli strike on Hamas in Qatar, but moved ahead with a visit to Israel that includes meetings with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Rubio said the U.S. wouldn't reassess its support for Israel, but stressed that President Trump was unhappy about the strike. We're going to talk about what the future holds, and I'm going to get a much better understanding of what their plans are moving forward, Rubio told reporters before boarding his flight to Tel Aviv. Obviously, we're not happy about it. The president was not happy about it. Now we need to move forward and figure out what comes next. The visit comes as the U.S. scrambles to react to the fallout from the Israeli strike and as Arab officials question America's willingness to protect them from growing Israeli power in the region. The trip also comes as the U.S. is struggling to break the logjam in negotiations to end the Israel-Hamas war. The latest diplomatic crisis sparked by Israel's strike on Qatar could pose a potential stumbling block to further negotiations, senior U.S. officials said. Still, Rubio's visit underscores how the U.S. is working to balance its steadfast support for Israel while containing the fallout from the strike. Putin, Netanyahu, march on with Trump on the sidelines. U.S. president has leverage with both leaders, but analysts say he isn't using it. By Michael R. Gordon, Alexander Ward, and Robbie Gramer. Washington. One is a close U.S. ally, the other is an adversary. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Russian President Vladimir Putin both have consistently disregarded President Trump's wishes, often without major consequences. His perceived passivity highlights a revealing paradox about Trump. Frequently claiming to have ended a half dozen wars, he portrays himself as an unmatched peacemaker. Yet, in the two conflicts, he has most often vowed to stop, Gaza and the Ukraine war, he has often been reluctant to exert U.S. leverage with Israel and Russia. Israel last Tuesday carried out missile strikes on Hamas political officials in Qatar who had gathered to discuss Trump's proposals for ending the Gaza fighting and securing the release of the hostages held by the U.S.-designated terrorist group. And Putin, after meeting with Trump in Alaska last month, escalated drone and missile attacks on Ukraine. Last week, forces from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's European members shot down Russian drones infiltrating Poland. Trump has done little publicly to respond to either event. He held a tense phone call with Netanyahu, followed by a second and friendlier conversation about the results of Israel's operation. He recently said that the attack hopefully wouldn't endanger the roughly 48 hostages Hamas still holds, despite fears from their families that the strike might disrupt the tenuous diplomacy. About 20 of the hostages are thought to still be alive, Trump said Friday on Fox News. Trump posed a vague question last Wednesday about the Russian drone incursion over Poland, the first time NATO ever shot down Russian aircraft venturing over its eastern flank, despite having a powerful intelligence apparatus at its beck and call. What's with Russia violating Poland's airspace with drones? Here we go, Trump posted on social media. The next day, he suggested the incursion could have been a mistake. But regardless, I'm not happy about anything to do with the whole situation. When European NATO members said Friday they were sending planes and other military forces to bolster the alliance's eastern flank defenses against Russian drones, no U.S. assets were announced. On Saturday, Trump added fresh conditions for imposing what he described as major sanctions on Russia, a move that some former officials said appeared to be calculated to put off White House decisions on stepped-up economic pressure. Trump wrote in a social media post that all nations in Europe, which has substantially reduced its import of Russian oil, would need to stop buying oil from Moscow. And he insisted that NATO nations put tariffs of 50% to 100% on China, which has provided support to Russia's defense industry, until the conflict in Ukraine has ended. This is not Trump's war, Trump wrote. It is Biden's and Zelensky's war. Trump administration officials insist the president has a firm grip on foreign policy, citing instances in which U.S. efforts helped pause or de-escalate fights abroad since taking office, including a brief conflict between India and Pakistan and border clashes between Cambodia and Thailand. His rapport with Netanyahu and Putin provides him with a diplomatic opening, according to the president's aides, and damaging those relationships would prove counterproductive to Trump's peace efforts and longer-term strategies in Europe and the Middle East. But some observers say one-on-one relationships alone won't end the wars, especially the one between Moscow and Kyiv. President Trump keeps saying he wants to end the war in Gaza, but he has done very little to bring about that result, and a lot that has contributed to its extension, such as loose talk of moving Palestinians out of Gaza, insufficient attention to the humanitarian crisis, and the acquiescence to the Israeli operation in Gaza City that puts hostages at risk, said Daniel Shapiro, a former Pentagon official during the Biden administration who is now at the Atlantic Council. The economy of Russia is suffering under significant U.S.-led sanctions. Yet, some observers have said the Trump administration hasn't done enough to enforce the ones already on the books while resisting congressional plans to impose newer and tougher penalties on Russia's energy sector. Trump targeted India, a U.S. ally, with increased tariffs for purchasing Moscow's oil without imposing similar measures on China, Russia's largest energy customer. While Trump is selling weapons to European nations that plan to send them to Ukraine, he has held back on donating American arms to Kyiv, nor has his Pentagon authorized the Ukrainians to use the ATACMS missiles that they have left to fire into Russian territory, as President Joe Biden did during his final months in office. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Markets stay hot, defying economic narrative. Fed is expected to cut rates this week, and some bet on a new burst of growth, by Jack Pitcher. The coolest trade on Wall Street is known as run it hot. While slowing job growth and tariff-related costs remain primary concerns for investors, the core of the trade lies in betting on an economic resurgence, not a recession. The thinking, tax cuts and falling interest rates will heat up the economy, fueling a new burst of growth. That line of reasoning has sent all manner of investments to records, from stocks to Bitcoin to gold. Even if the labor market weakens further, many investors believe the near-term outlook remains bright, which they expect to fuel further gains across markets. We've got an economy that's still growing, said Nelson Yu, head of equities at active asset manager AllianceBernstein. It's not falling off a cliff, and I think it actually should be a pretty good environment for risk assets if the central bank can start cutting rates. The Federal Reserve has signaled it is likely to cut short-term rates this month, and Wall Street expects more in the months ahead. Fed officials are meeting this week. Whirlpool suggests rivals are evading tariff bills, by John Kilman. The appliance maker Whirlpool is stirring up a new trade dispute, telling the Trump administration that its overseas competitors could be evading hefty tariff bills by undervaluing their imports. Its claims are based on federal data generated from import paperwork. Whirlpool said the data shows that the declared customs value of numerous appliances started to plummet in June. A smaller declared value would mean a lower tariff payment. A Wall Street Journal review of the data shows that garbage disposals from China dropped from an average of $21 over the first 5 months of the year to $9 in June, and then less than $8 in July. Gas ranges from Thailand more than halved to $175. Washing machines from South Korea sank from $838 to $73. The retail prices of those appliances which carry tariff rates ranging from 13% to 60% haven't shown a corresponding drop, Whirlpool said. Toxic fumes are leaking into airplanes. Doctors compare brain effects on some sickened crew members to concussions. By Benjamin Katz, John West, and Andrew Tangel. Do you smell that? Florence Chesson was asked by a fellow JetBlue flight attendant as they prepared for landing in Puerto Rico. Chesson, as trained, inhaled a lungful of air through her nostrils in a single deep breath. It smells like dirty feet, she told her colleague. Instantly, she started to feel like she had been drugged, Chesson said in an interview. About an hour later, the aircraft had landed, loaded a fresh group of passengers, and was back in the sky returning to Boston. As Chesson wrapped up the drink service, a colleague rushed past to the back of the plane, her hands around her mouth, complaining she was struggling to breathe before starting to vomit. Another was given emergency oxygen. When the flight landed, the two cabin crew were taken to a hospital in an ambulance, one on a stretcher. Chesson, her uniform and hair soaked in sweat, and with an overpowering metallic taste in her mouth, went to meet her supervisor. I felt like I was talking gibberish, she recalled. I remember being very repetitive, saying, "What just happened to me? What just happened to me?" After months of worsening symptoms, Chesson was diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury and permanent damage to her peripheral nervous system caused by the fumes she inhaled. Her doctor, Robert Konecki, a neurologist and consultant to the Pittsburgh Steelers, said in an interview that the effects on her brain were akin to a chemical concussion and extraordinarily similar to those of a National Football League linebacker after a brutal hit. It's impossible not to draw that conclusion, he said. The fumes, sometimes described as smelling of wet dog, Cheetos, or nail polish, have led to emergency landings, sickened passengers, and affected pilots' vision and reaction times mid-flight, according to official reports. The cause of the fume events isn't a mystery. Airbus and Boeing, the two biggest aircraft manufacturers, have acknowledged that malfunctions can lead to oil and hydraulic fluid leaking into the engines or power units and vaporizing at extreme heat. This results in the release of unknown quantities of neurotoxins, carbon monoxide, and other chemicals into the air. Manufacturers, regulators, and airlines have said these types of incidents are too infrequent, levels of contamination too low, and scientific research on lasting health risks too inconclusive to warrant a comprehensive fix. It's subsidies or shutdown for Democrats. Party says restoring billions in health insurance credits is the price of their vote. By Siobhan Hughes, Lindsay Wise, and Anna Wild Matthews. Washington. The next federal funding deadline is just weeks away. Democrats say restoring billions of dollars in health insurance subsidies for Americans is the minimum price of their vote, holding the threat of a shutdown over Republicans' heads. Democrats are more confident in their negotiating stance compared with March, when a similar attempt to play hardball fizzled. While today's talks pit them against Republican leaders who want a 2-month spending deal with no big additions, they are finding support among rank-and-file GOP lawmakers, fearing political backlash if their voters are hit by higher health insurance bills next year. Republicans have to come to meet with us in a true bipartisan negotiation to satisfy the American people's needs on health care, or they won't get our votes, plain and simple. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, said Thursday. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican from South Dakota, said he was open to discussions about extending the subsidies, but not as a condition of a short-term spending bill he has proposed to keep the government open into November. Such an extension would give Congress more time to iron out full-year spending deals. The fight centers on the extension of expiring Affordable Care Act tax credits. The subsidies, which expanded the payments offered under the existing ACA, or Obamacare, were first passed in 2021 by Democrats as a temporary measure tied to a COVID-19 aid bill. Republicans didn't renew them in their sprawling tax and spending legislation President Trump signed in July, meaning they will expire at the end of this year. About 24.3 million Americans are enrolled in Obamacare, with about 22.4 million of them receiving subsidies, according to health researcher KFF. All of those subsidies would shrink or be zeroed out if the additional enhancement ended. In the past, Republicans have opposed both Obamacare and the extra subsidies. While ending the extra payments would serve the broader GOP goal to cut government spending, it would leave the party vulnerable heading into the 2026 midterms, when Republicans will work to hang on to their narrow control of the House and Senate. From the World Watch. Pope turns 70, cites learning curve. Pope Leo XIV marveled at the learning curve he has taken on as pontiff and likened some aspect of the job to jumping into the deep end of the pool. In excerpts of an interview released on Sunday, his 70th birthday, the first American pope also lamented widening income gaps between the working class and CEOs. The interview was conducted this summer by Vatican correspondent Elise Ann Allen for her coming biography. U.S. forces board local tuna boat. Personnel from a U.S. warship boarded a Venezuelan tuna boat carrying 9 fishermen while it was sailing in Venezuelan waters, Venezuela's foreign minister said, underlining strained relations with the U.S. The White House didn't respond to a request for comment. Tensions escalated after President Trump in August ordered the deployment of warships off the coast, citing the fight against Latin American drug cartels. Foreign Minister Yvonne Gill said the Venezuelan tuna boat was illegally and hostilely boarded by a United States Navy destroyer and 18 armed personnel who remained on the vessel for 8 hours. Nepal. New Prime Minister takes office, urges calm. Prime Minister Sushila Karki took office on Sunday and urged calm and cooperation to rebuild the Himalayan nation after days of violent protests last week left at least 72 people dead and destroyed government buildings and politicians' homes. Nepal's first female prime minister told top officials gathered at her temporary office that each family of slain protesters will receive monetary compensation of about $11,330 and assured that those injured would be taken care of, state television reported. The massive demonstrations began on September 8th over a short-lived social media ban. The protests soon turned violent, leading to the resignation of Prime Minister Kasaga Prasad Oli. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, a politician rises to the occasion. Utah Governor Spencer Cox offers a lesson in moral and political leadership. A 22-year-old man is now in custody in Utah as the country weathers the aftershocks of the public murder of Charlie Kirk, the young political leader and father. A solace is that the justice system is moving swiftly, and at least some politicians in America have decided to meet the raw moment with wise counsel. Utah GOP Governor Spencer Cox said in a press conference Friday, announcing the arrest of suspect Tyler Robinson, that a casing found by law enforcement was engraved with the phrase, "Hey, fascists, catch." Another, "If you read this, you are gay." LMAO stands for Laughing My Ass Off. We'll learn more in the coming days, but this looks like another young man full of rage and unhinged from reality with help from the internet. Yet perhaps the most important part of the press conference was Mr. Cox's reflection on the country's condition after an attack on the American experiment. "To my young friends out there, you are inheriting a country where politics feels like rage," he said. "It feels like rage is the only option. But your generation has an opportunity to build a culture that is very different from what we are suffering through right now. Not by pretending differences don't matter, but by embracing our differences and having those hard conversations. Then I think we need more moral clarity right now. I hear all the time that words are violence. Words are not violence. Violence is violence. And there is one person responsible for what happened here. And that person is now in custody and will be charged soon and will be held accountable. This is important wisdom for young Americans whose political formation will now include this assassination. And Mr. Cox performed far better than most of his colleagues in positions of political leadership. These people are full of is the level of statesmanship America now expects from Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. But the failures are bipartisan. Democrats owned what happened today, said South Carolina GOP Representative Nancy Mace. The left hasn't reckoned with what it unleashed when it declared that words are equivalent to violence, which some unstable people hear as an open call to return fire. Yet what the country needs at this moment is leaders who understand that they represent everyone once they are elected, not merely a political faction. This is what the country could also use from President Trump, rather than vows to punish his opponents. Mr. Cox told Americans to log off, turn off, touch grass, hug a family member, go out and do good in your community, while calling social media a cancer. Don't underestimate the political salience of this message to voters who all know someone whose mental stability has deteriorated after hours spent marinating in online rage. History will dictate if this is a turning point for our country, Mr. Cox said. But every single one of us gets to choose right now if this is a turning point for us. It has been a bleak week for the greatest free society in history. But Mr. Cox is right to tell Americans that their personal conduct can be a starting point towards something different. From the opinion pages, Tyler Robinson and America's Lost Boys. What causes a young man to spiral from success toward loneliness, self-destruction, and violence? By Alicia Finley. The descent of Tyler Robinson, the 22-year-old man suspected of murdering Charlie Kirk, is itself a tragedy worth mourning. How did a high school whiz kid devolve into an assassin? Such spirals aren't so uncommon among young men, even if Mr. Robinson's played out in a more calamitous and public way than most. Political violence is a problem. But so is the atomized culture in which young men retreat into confused inner worlds and virtual realities, which can be as addictive and destructive as any drug. Mr. Robinson's relatively normal background makes his actions jarring. He came from a good middle-class family. Having excelled in high school, he was awarded a scholarship to Utah State University, though he dropped out after one semester. At some point, he appears to have become steeped in a dark digital world and video games. He inscribed ammunition with obscure online memes. Notices, bulges, OWO, what's this? Lyrics to an anti-fascist Italian song and an apparent reference to the video game Helldivers 2. A satire of a fascist interstellar empire inspired by the 1997 movie Starship Troopers. Marinating in an internet cesspool can't be good for the young and malleable male mind. Might killing villains in video games desensitize the conscience? Studies have found an association between playing violent video games and aggressive behavior, though most people who assume online avatars and fight monsters don't become violent. A broader problem, as Jonathan Haidt explains in his book, The Anxious Generation, is that video games cause boys to get lost in cyberspace. They have put some users into a vicious cycle because they use gaming to distract themselves from feelings of loneliness, Mr. Haidt notes. Over time, they developed a reliance on the games instead of forming long-term friendships. They retreat to their bedrooms rather than doing the hard work of maturing in the real world. The same is true of social media platforms like Discord and Reddit, where young men often seek fraternity under pseudonyms. The platforms become substitutes for real-world camaraderie and can lead men down dark holes. Frequent social media use has been found to rewire neurological pathways in young brains and compromise judgment. Mr. Robinson's spiral recalls Luigi Maggioni, the 27-year-old University of Pennsylvania graduate who allegedly shot and killed UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson on a New York City street. Attractive and athletic, Mr. Maggioni developed an obsession with self-improvement even as he suffered bouts of excruciating back pain. He was also an avid video game player and active on Reddit. Prior to the shooting, he cut off communications with family and friends. Men in their late teens and 20s sometimes experience psychotic breaks. Mr. Maggioni's apparent mental health struggles, however, seem to have gone unnoticed as he got lost in a digital wilderness. Or consider Thomas Crooks, the 20-year-old who attempted to assassinate President Trump at a rally last summer. Crooks graduated high school with high honors and scored 1530 on the SAT, then enrolled in an engineering program at a community college. His father said his mental health began declining in the year before the shooting. Crooks lost social connections as he started spending more time online, visiting news sites, gaming platforms, Reddit, and weapons blogs. He, at one point, searched for information on major depressive disorder and depression crisis, suggesting he suspected he had a mental illness. Instead of psychiatric treatment, he turned to the internet. Like drugs, the internet can fuel delusions. Patrick Joseph White, 30, last month opened fire on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention headquarters in Atlanta, then fatally shot himself. He was apparently exercising his rage against COVID shots, which he wrote were always meant to indiscriminately murder as many as possible, and believed had caused his depression. He had threatened self-harm numerous times in the previous year. In April, police officers came to his home after he called a veterans crisis line and said he had been drinking and taking medication. White told officers he had called the crisis line just to talk to someone. Video games and the digital world may not cause mental illness, but they can be a form of self-medication that provides illusory relief from emotional troubles, even as they propel antisocial behavior. The solution isn't to ban them, but to create social structures that prevent young men from falling through the cracks. Lost boys pose a broader cultural problem. The share of men 20 to 34 who work has been declining over the past 30 years, even as employment among young women has increased. Too many young men spend their days playing video games, watching porn, smoking pot, and trolling the internet rather than engaging with the real world. Mr. Kirk sought to bring young people like Mr. Robinson out of their virtual caves. It's harder to hate someone you meet in the flesh than an avatar in a digital dystopia. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, HHS tries to stifle corporate speech. The FDA wants to regulate pharma ads so they are not feasible. Conservatives rightly criticize the Biden team for trying to suppress speech they disliked. Well, now, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his crew at the Health and Human Services Department are doing the same against the pharmaceutical industry they dislike. Mr. Kennedy and Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Marty McCary last week announced a crackdown on what they call deceptive drug advertising. Only radical transparency will break the cycle of over-medicalization that drives America's chronic disease epidemic, Mr. Kennedy said. What's really going on here is an effort to use government regulation to ban advertising for pharmaceuticals. This is a longtime project of the political left and Mr. Kennedy. But because this would violate the First Amendment, he's trying to do it by the back door. The FDA currently requires drug makers to disclose significant side effects in their ads and provide a fair balance of information. Since 1997, the agency has allowed drug makers to direct consumers to a website and speak with a medical professional to learn more about a medicine's risks rather than list every potential minor side effect. That's because research has shown that consumers tune out serious side effects when they hear a laundry list of minor and rare risks. Mr. Kennedy and Dr. McCary plan to require manufacturers to disclose all and sundry potential side effects anyway. Dr. McCary also said the FDA is implementing AI and other tech-enabled tools to proactively surveil and review drug ads. The message? Drug makers advertise at their own legal risk. Commissioner McCary gave away his goal in a CNBC interview. The FDA, he said, will require more disclosure and longer ads that may make the ads no longer feasible. He may come to regret that statement because government isn't allowed to burden speech as an indirect way to ban it. Courts require that regulations of commercial speech be no more burdensome than necessary to advance a substantial government purpose. What is the government's purposely compelling purpose in banning ads? Dr. McCary says ads distort the doctor-patient relationship and create increased demand for medications regardless of clinical appropriateness. But doctors can decide whether or not to prescribe a drug. He also says drug makers should spend more time on lowering prices for consumers, but restricting advertising won't reduce drug prices. The pharma ad clampdown is left-wing paternalism. Does Dr. McCary not trust doctors to act in patients' best interest? It reflects the thinking of Vinay Prasad, a Bernie Sanders acolyte who is Dr. McCary's left-hand man. Dr. Prasad has advocated banning pharma ads because he thinks they encourage doctors to prescribe too many drugs with marginal benefits. But the most commonly advertised drugs these days include GLP-1 therapies for diabetes and weight loss, anti-AIDS medicines, and those that treat afflictions like eczema or mental illness. Dr. Prasad's real concern is that a company might make money from developing these treatments. Meanwhile, RFK Jr.'s friends in the wellness industry are hawking supplements with unproven benefits and misleading claims. Unlike drugs, supplements don't have to be approved by the FDA and prove they are safe or effective. Consumers can also buy them without a doctor's prescription, which makes them potentially more risky. It's up to the Federal Trade Commission to police claims of supplement makers, and RFK's acolytes have urged the Trump administration to back off. The Trump team this spring dropped a lawsuit against a company run by a vaccine skeptic that falsely claimed a sinus rinse containing xylitol, an artificial sweetener, prevented and treated COVID. Kaylee Means, a Kennedy advisor, launched an internet platform that peddles supplements with gauzy claims, such as improving endurance and memory formation. The platform's merchants include Mr. Kennedy's friend, Mark Hyman, who sells products that purport to help maintain healthy cholesterol, blood sugar, and pressure. Mr. Kennedy demands radical transparency for some, but not for others. From the opinion pages, therapists understand the pathology of those who take joy in assassination, but some encourage it. Splitting and the Celebration of Violence by Jonathan Elbert. Hours after Charlie Kirk was gunned down, I overheard a customer in a Manhattan store. I agree he was evil, and I don't think he could have been shot by anyone more evil. The cashier replied, "Trump will get worse now." Their words were chillingly calm. The murder was horrific. The validation, the ease with which people justified or even savored it, was its own kind of horror. It revealed something deeper. As a psychotherapist, I recognize the pattern. I hear it in my office when anger hardens into fantasy. A partner becomes toxic. A boss is evil. Once someone is cast as beyond repair, fantasies of his elimination follow. If only he were gone, everything would be better. Psychologists call this defense mechanism splitting, seeing the world in black and white terms. The fantasy feels like relief, but it corrodes judgment. It blinds people to their own role in conflict and at times spills into violence. Good therapy interrupts that slide. Bad therapy nods along and validates it. In recent years, therapy has increasingly become political, encouraging patients to see disagreements as harm and opponents as dangerous. Figures like Charlie Kirk and Donald Trump are no longer merely political opponents. They are cast as existential threats. Once that frame is in place, it isn't surprising that some feel satisfaction when violence strikes. After the assassination attempt against Mr. Trump in July 2024, several of my patients admitted they were disappointed he had survived. One said it would have spared us the next 4 years. Another said she felt cheated that the shooter missed. Then she paused as if waiting for my approval. That expectation was what unsettled me most, the assumption that her hatred was not only permissible, but obvious. When a patient tells me someone deserved to die, I don't let it pass. I ask him to look at what he is saying. That interruption is the essence of therapy. But when the same mindset surfaces in politics, who has the authority to interrupt? This pathology isn't confined to the left. In my office and on social media, I have heard conservatives call progressives traitors, radicals, and groomers. The logic is the same. Once an opponent is painted not merely wrong, but evil, violence begins to feel like justice. In the same way that some therapists validate grievance instead of challenging it, political allies often encourage us to see opponents as villains to be eliminated. When someone voices rage or fantasies of destruction in the therapy room, too often the reflex is to nod along rather than confront it. That may make people feel heard, but it makes them sicker. In my practice, I confront it because otherwise hurt turns into obsession. In politics, it turns grievance into violence. Good therapy asks, what part of this story is yours? What would it mean to grieve instead of hate? I have seen patients fall silent when I ask such questions. The first break in their certainty and often the first glimpse of clarity. Our politics could use an intervention like that. The more politics mimics therapy at its worst, the more polarization deepens. Mr. Albert is a psychotherapist practicing in New York and Washington and author of Therapy Nation, forthcoming in 2026. The Pepper and Salt cartoon today shows two women, presumably at a cocktail party, where one husband has a bucket over his head. And the caption, we will be leaving soon. That's our prearranged signal for when Howard's had enough chit-chat. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 15th, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day or evening.